In the reign of Emperor Go-Nara, the 108th emperor since the days of Jimmu, sometime about the Koji period, a southern barbarian trading vessel came to our shores. From this ship, for the first time, emerged an unnameable creature, somewhat similar in shape to a human being, but looking rather more like a long-nosed goblin, or the giant demon Mekoshi Nyudo. Upon close interrogation, it was discovered that this was a being called Bateren. The length of his nose was the first thing which attracted attention. It was like a conch shell, though without the surface warts, attached by suction to his face. His eyes were as large as spectacles, and their insides were yellow. His head was small. On his hands and feet, he had long claws. His height exceeded 7 feet, and he was black all over, only his nose was red. His teeth were longer than the teeth of a horse, his hair was mouse grey in colour, and over his brow was a shaved spot in the outline of a wine bowl turned over. What he said could not be understood at all. His voice was like the screech of an owl. He was dressed in a garment called habito, which looked somewhat like a piece of felt carpet. It was mouse grey in colour, with long sleeves and the skirt slit. Wearing this garment, he looked for all the world like a bat spreading its wings. Word had spread that he was coming to pay obeisance to Oda Nobunaga, so that great lords and lesser lords of all Japan, minor officials, townsmen, all rushed to see the sight. Really, it was like the Gion procession or the Sanno festival. You could hardly push your way through the crowds. One and all rushed to see him, crowding all the roads in total lack of restraint. And all were agreed that this apparition was even more dreadful than the fiercest of goblins could ever be. His name was Urugan Bateren. Though at heart he planned to spread the Kirishitan religion, he seemed intent first to survey the wisdom of the Japanese people. And he brought with him all sort and manner of curious things from South Barbary. To the south of Kyushu, 18 ri off the shore, there is an island called Tenegashima. My forebears have lived there for generations. According to a legend from ancient times, the name Tenegashima, the Seed Island, is derived from the fact that the number of inhabitants, in spite of the smallness of the island, has grown and prospered like seeds, which, once planted, grow and produce new seeds without number. Some years ago, in the Tenbun era, on the 25th day of the 8th month in the autumn of the Year of the Hare, a big ship arrived at dawn at Nishinomura Bay. No one knew from what country it came. There were some 100 people on board, among whom were those whose physical features were different from ours, whose language was not understood. Among them was a scholar from Great Ming. His personal name was Go-Ho, but now nothing is surely known about his family name. The chieftain of Nishinomura at that time was Oribonojo, who knew written Chinese well. By chance meeting with Go-Ho, he conversed with him by writing in the sand with a stick. He wrote, "We do not know what country these people on board come from. They look strange, do they not?" Go-Ho wrote in reply, "They are traders from among the southwestern barbarians. They have some knowledge of the relationship between superior and inferior, but otherwise they do not know about propriety. Therefore, when they drink, they don't use cups, and when they eat, they use their fingers and not chopsticks as we do. They show their feelings without any self-control, and they do not know the written script or the use of it. Such traders are in the habit of roving from place to place, bartering things which they have for those that they do not have. They are not very strange, and are, withal, quite harmless." When the report of the foreign ship was made to my grandfather, Shigetoki, and my father, Tokitaka, the latter, Tokitaka, dispatched tens of boats to fetch the ship to Akogi, where it arrived 2 days later. Visiting the port at that time was a monk. He was well versed in the Chinese classics and known for his agility with the brush. He happened to meet Goho, and they conversed in writing, and Goho, too, felt that he had found a true friend in a foreign land. They spoke, as it were, in the same language and understood each other. Goho explained there were two leaders among the traders, the one called Murashuku Sha, and the other Kurishita Demota. They had in their possession an object which was about 2 or 3 shaku in length. As for its shape, it was straight on the outside with a passage inside, and made of a heavy substance. Even though its inside was hollow, its bottom end was closed. There was an aperture at its side through which fire was applied. Its shape could not be compared with anything else. When used, some mysterious medicine powder was put into it, and a small lead pellet was added. At first, a small white target was set upon a bank. When it was discharged, the man gripped the object with one hand, straightened his posture, and squinted with one eye. When thereupon fire issued from the opening, the pellet always hit the target squarely. The explosion seemed like lightning, and the sound like rolling thunder. All bystanders covered their ears. Setting up a small target is like placing a swan target in archery. One shot from this object can make a mountain of silver crumble and break through a wall of iron. Someone with aggression in mind toward a neighboring country would lose his life instantly when hit. Needless to say, this also holds for the deer that ravaged the rice just planted. The many ways this object can be used in the world cannot possibly be counted. On seeing it, Lord Tokitaka thought it was the Wonder of Wonders. At first, people didn't know what to call it, nor exactly what it was used for. At last, people called it Teppo, firearm. But it was not known whether it was named so by the Ming Chinese or by the people on the island. One day, Tokitaka said to the two barbarians by means of double interpretation, "I do not think that I am able, but I would like to learn to shoot it." The two barbarians, also using double interpretation, answered, "If you, Lord, would like to learn to shoot it, we would love to teach you its secrets." Tokitaka said, "Can I really learn all its secrets?" The barbarians said, "The secrets lie only in rectifying your heart and in squinting one eye." Tokitaka said, "As for rectifying the heart, the ancient sages taught people how to do it and I have learnt it. If, generally, one does not follow the principle under heaven in action, movement and rest, one will necessarily end up in error. What you mean with rectifying the heart, however, is perhaps something different. If you squint with one eye, you will not be able to see what is far away. Why should one, therefore, squint with one eye?" The barbarians responded, "This is where concentration comes in and is necessary. When concentrating, a long vision is not necessary. Closing one eye does not mean that you cannot see clearly, but that one is concentrating and wishes to hit what is far away. That is what you should consider, Lord." Delighted, Tokitaka said, "To see what is small clearly, that is called clarity. Is not this what you talk about?" That year, the day of the festival of the 9th day of the 9th month fell on the Boar Day, and this day was chosen as the lucky day to shoot the musket. For trial, the wondrous powder and a pellet were put into the barrel, a small target was set up around 100 steps away, and fire was applied to the weapon. And lo and behold, the target was hit almost in dead center. People were at first startled, then they became frightened. In the end, however, they all said in unison, "We would like to learn." Regardless of the high price, Tokitaka purchased 2 teppo from the barbarians and kept them as precious treasures of his house. As for the art of grinding, sifting, and mixing the wondrous medicine, Tokitaka had his retainer, Shinokawa Koshiru, learn it. Tokitaka practiced shooting incessantly from morning to evening. As a result, he was able to convert the misses of his early attempts into hits. 100 hits out of 100 shots. Tokitaka's interest in the weapon was so enthusiastic that he had a number of iron workers examine and study it carefully. Through months and over seasons, they worked with the objective of producing a new musket. The form of this new weapon was much like the foreign original, but the workers could not figure out how to close the bottom end of the barrel. The following year, southern barbarian traders came again and entered Kumano Bay on our island. As luck had it, there was among the traders one blacksmith, whom Tokitaka regarded as a godsend, and he ordered Lord Kinbi Kiyosada to learn how to close the end of the barrel that fitted into the stock. And in a little more than a year, several tens of teppo were manufactured. The people in the province saw it and marveled. They saw, watched, and copied, and there were many who learnt to use it. Afterwards, there was not a place in the eastern eight provinces and along the shores of our land to which it was not brought, and where they did not learn to use it. Now, more than 60 years have gone since this object came to our land. There are some grey-haired people who still remember the event clearly. This could happen because our Lord Tokitaka procured the two teppo from the above-mentioned barbarians and learned to use them. The first shot from them reverberated through the 60 provinces of our country. It is hence certain that the teppo originated in our Tanegashima. In ancient times, people chose the simile of one seed growing and becoming new seeds without number, and so our island was called Tanegashima. Now it has been the first seed in the same manner. At that time, Prince Oda Nobunaga was master over the empire. Like the wind that makes all the grasses and trees bend before its gusts, he vanquished and subjugated the savages of the east, the barbarians of the south, the wild men of the north, and the hordes of the west, thus setting at peace the empire. At Azuchi, in the province of Omi, he built his castle, furnishing it with a splendor the likes of which even Xianyang Palace had never seen. Once in the course of an evening's conversation, he heard tell of that Urugan Bateren, and he uttered the desire to see the creature as soon as possible. Suganoya Koemono was given orders to convey the Bateren to Nobunaga's residence, and thus he arrived at Azuchi. After 2 or 3 days, the Bateren appeared before Nobunaga to pay obeisance. For presents, he brought 10 muskets, far-seeing and near-seeing spectacles, a mosquito net big enough to cover an 8-mat room, yet fine enough to fit into a tiny perfume container when folded, some 30 yards of cloth of orangutan, picture scrolls, medicines, goats and sheep, Cathay dogs, and many other artifacts in overwhelming number. Prince Nobunaga was not at all displeased. He gave the Bateren a plot of land for a residence, and had a colossal temple built for him. And so sometime around the Bunroku period, during the reign of Taiko Hideyoshi, a great many Bateren called Furaten were sent over to Japan. It is not by a miracle that the Kirishitans are not covetous and refrain from fawning on their parishioners. For the king of South Barbary each year dispatches a black ship, and everyone gets his share, including simple parishioners, if their faith be deep. So it is no wonder that they appear to be uncovetous and prudent, and moreover, day and night they eat the flesh of cows, horses, swine, chickens, and meaner yet. Anxious thus to adapt the manner of wild beasts, many became members of their religion mainly for the taste of such foods, or so report has it. It appears that in their own country they had been priests much given to devotions, but here in Japan, they went out onto the streets and gathered beggars and the outcasts of society around them. They gave remarkable medical treatment to the hare-lipped, to lepers, to wretches afflicted with boils and carbuncles, with the Chinese pox and with mange, thus enticing them to join their religion. And beggars were given a meal if they expressed the desire to become members of the religion. To those of the middle level of society who had become disillusioned with this world, they taught their heretical doctrines and made their way through life seem easier. In return, they were pulled into the Kirishitan religion. The young, the extravagant, the indiscreet, and the affected were tricked with newfangled bric-a-brac. Those whom they deemed great lords they flattered with gifts of baubles and beads, long-seeing spectacles, and similar fare, thus involving them in an ever-deepening relationship and finally deluding them into joining the Kurishtan faith. They built temples every place and everywhere, in Osaka, in Sakai, in Nagasaki, in Yamaguchi of Suo province, in Hiroshima, in Okayama of Bizen, in Himeji, and in the capital, they built great temples. Morons, menials, and misfits, they took in everybody and rejected nobody. And thus, they gathered around themselves a bunch of good-for-nothings. One day, a group of Iruman concocted a plot together with some of their most trusted parishioners. News of this criminal activity leaked out, and now the wrath of Hideyoshi exceeded all bounds. Hearing of their secret plans to spread their pernicious doctrines and to delude the populace, he decided that it was high time to slash at their very roots. How fortunate for Japan, for he determined to purge the land of them. But now, all sorts of apologies were sent from Nagasaki so that he relented on the point of expelling them from Japan. Only the actual criminals were put in carts at the crossroads and were sent off, their ears and nose slit. There were 25 in all. Six of them were Bateren, eight Iruman, the rest were oblates and lay believers. They were dragged through the capital and then they were dragged to Nagasaki. Along the way, they were constantly looking for a miracle from Deus, gazing up at the sky, peering across the mountains. But there wasn't even a dewdrop of a miracle, and their faces became drawn with fright and disappointment. They were crucified in Nagasaki. Their bones were stolen by other believers, and afterwards the crosses, too, were whittled down to toothpicks. These relics were used as amulets, and what is more, so report has it, they later bartered at high prices. Well then, the Kurishtan version of the Buddhist doctrine tells us that at the time heaven and earth were opened up, the one Buddha, called Deus, made his appearance, creating the sun and the moon and illuminating the world. Following Deus's teachings, by what means can this ambition be attained? There is konfisan, to come into the presence of the Buddha, do penance and contrition, and pray for happiness in the future world. There is Kwaresma, similar to the Japanese devotion of reading the sutras. While reciting his scripture, the Kurishtan strikes his chest with resounding blows. This appears to be a practice meant to demonstrate that there is in the heart no thought but earnest adoration of Deus and Santa Maria. Next, he raises a pointing finger while directing his gaze up at heaven. This signifies worship, reciprocating the protection which Deus from heaven above bestows upon this world. And for the evening, there is the penitentia. In his mouth, the believer mutters contrition for all his accumulated misdeeds, and flogs his back with an object somewhat like a fly swatter spiked with copper thorns, besmirching himself with blood, and all the while intoning Zensumaru. For an amulet, the Kurishtan strings around his neck, to these beads is tied a cruciform, and he fingers them away from his body, continuously intoning Zensumaru. And the thing called cruz he values as all-important, all the profundity of a saucer's depths, or so it would seem. But what about the appearance of the Kurishitan Temple? It contains a room of mystery, in which is on display an image of Deus, fashioned in the most gruesome manner, hanging upon a cross. This appears to be a device to extract tears of emotion from their sectarians, by showing off this figure of agony and mortification. And so they praise this religion and find satisfaction in it. Indeed, they think determinedly that this way they can attain Buddhahood. Though they be roasted alive, be torn in two by oxen or carriages, or be crucified head down, though they meet with such tortures, there appear to be none among them that would grudge their lives, so confident are they of attaining their desire of Buddhahood. How pitiful it is. Once a fool has turned a ready ear to something and set his heart on it, nothing will change his mind. To use an analogy, a child of 2 or 3 in seeing a reflection in a mirror thinks it an actual figure. A monkey in seeing the moon on the surface of the water tries to grab it. For such is the simplicity of their minds. All fools are like that. About the first year of the Genna period, the Kirishitan faith was enjoying great prosperity in Osaka. Samurai, townsmen, and masterless desperados all gathered before the gates of the Kirishitan's temple and made of it a marketplace. And the widow of a daimyo, though she was past her 6th decade, was having the Kirishitan faith pressed quite urgently upon her. An Iruman, hearing of this and considering that women are very easily cheated, now said to the widow, "In the Buddhist doctrine of Deus, the place of repose is called paraiso, a place of comfort and delight. It is a place which knows neither hot nor cold, a place where musical instruments called organs play delightful tunes, indeed much like those of Japan, for the amusement and enjoyment of the blessed." To this the widow replied, "I am a mere woman and therefore cannot follow all these distinctions. But it does seem to me that what you say here is but very clever talk, and cannot be right. In the final analysis, here is the best thing to do. Select from among the Kirishitans one well-versed Iruman, and I will seek out a person learned in the Buddhist doctrine. We can have them debate religion, and I shall join the side of the one who wins." Night came and candles were lit. It was time to start the religious bout. Screens and room partitions were removed and a great hall thus created. In it an audience of some 200 sat, all eager to take in the proceedings. Not even a cough disturbed the silence. The Iruman now said, "The Buddha called Deus is the Buddha who opened up heaven and earth and gave them a beginning. And in this emptiness, Deus created the myriad phenomena of the universe, man and beasts, grasses and trees, sun and moon, everything. South Barbary is a great country, and compared to it, 500 or even 1,000 Japans would be like the one strand of hair set against the 9 head of cattle." In his edict, the king of South Barbary expressed the thought, "The people of Japan are to be pitied for their ignorance of the true law." And so he caused his emissaries to cross over to Japan, braving the perils of 10,000 miles of the deep blue sea. To this, the Japanese man replied, "Let's strike at the floors, and you just listen without interruptions. First of all, leaving aside the nonsense about Deus creating the myriad phenomena of the universe, let's find out just why he might have created humans. What could his purpose have been, I ask you? For it couldn't possibly have been no purpose at all. So was it to have a plaything, like a pet bird, say? Or perhaps Milord felt lonely by himself and created man in order to have a confidant, a partner in conversation, or a jester? Deus must have had some set purpose in mind, or didn't he? Well, answer." But the Kirishitan, thrown into confusion, only talked into the four winds and could not come up with a quick response. Then the Buddhist continued, "My second objection is this. If it were true that Deus created human beings, why then did he not at the same time establish one religion for all the people encompassed by heaven and the four seas? So now he has to face the dangers of thousands, nay, tens of thousands of miles, all for the sake of spreading his doctrine to this little land. What a stupid Buddha he must be." Without anyone asking him, Deus created human beings and then he also created Paraiso and Inferno, and now he lifts humans up or drops them down, ruled only by his own caprice and fancy. Perhaps they nailed him to the cross because of the grudge they bore him for causing this suffering. At any rate, this Deus looks like a devil to me. Eventually, the ruler of Japan thought it quite pitiable that poor illiterates, upon hearing the teachings of this devilish hearsay, should take them for truth, and bestowing his grace upon them, he granted pardon to those who would leave it. But this news did not remain unheard in South Barbary. Forthwith, the doctrinal standpoint was changed to state that one was free to renounce the faith any number of times as long as his internal devotion remained unchanged. This was transmitted to Japan, along with a bit of gold for each kirishitan, which was secretly distributed. More and more, their plans to subvert the country came out into the open. The ruler's hate for them now grew deep indeed. Orders were sent to the Lord's Protector, Lord Stewart, magistrates, and other officials throughout Japan to scour every last place in the country for kirishitans. Village by village, mountain hut upon mountain hut, island by island, fisher's cove upon fisher's cove. No place was to be omitted. Down to the last baby born yesterday or today, all were to be registered in the rolls of Buddhist parish temples. Pledges written in the most uncompromising terms had to be presented to the authorities. I and my whole family, children and grandchildren, definitely declare ourselves to be parishioners of this temple. If even one among us should prove to be of the kirishitan persuasion, then the temple shall be confiscated and the priest subjected to any applicable punishment. To make sure that none who reneged escaped undetected, these pledges had to be repeated once a year, by townsmen to the ward elders and their assistants on monthly rotation, by villagers to the village headman and chief peasant, by samurai to their group leader. Moreover, notice boards offering rewards for information about kirishitans were erected in settlements throughout every province. All too often, some 10 or 20 were discovered here and there, and were put to the fire, or crucified upside down, or subjected to the ordeal by water. And yet despite these various punishments, more are being discovered even these days. How strange it is. Barbarians from foreign lands came here to spread their cursed doctrine, and, despising the Buddhas and the gods, to destroy them and do away with them, determined thereby to make of Japan a domain of devils. How wretched it was, how lamentable. Men of wisdom spent their days and nights in grief and sorrow over this. But then, the kirishitans were exterminated, without being allowed to grasp an inch of our soil, to stand on a foot of our land. And all the major and minor deities of our 60 and more provinces, all the Buddhas of the three worlds rejoiced thereat, extending their protection for 10,000 eternities and a myriad years. The empire is at peace, the land in tranquility, the reign of longevity. The people partake of the virtue of the ruler and his subject princes. Verily, our age can be called another sainted reign of Engi, a golden age indeed. You've been watching Voices of the Past.